Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Folks, thanks for coming along tonight for our discussion on the election score at halftime, the players, the stumbles, the issues. And we have two well-known speakers, both of whom make a welcome return to the Sydney Institute. Carolyn Overington, who is the Associate Editor of The Australian. Her non-fiction book, The Last Woman Hanged, was launched at the Sydney Institute a couple of years ago, and her most recent book, which is a novel and selling very well, is The One Who Got Away. And Aaron Patrick is back at the Sydney Institute. He's the Deputy Editor of The Australian Financial Review. He spoke here last time on his book, Downfall, on the Rudd-Gillard-Rudd government, and his most recent book is Credlin and Co. on the Tony Abbott government. So we're going to lead off with Carolyn. We'll go to Aaron. They'll both speak for 15 minutes each. We'll take questions and discussion in the normal way. Carolyn, you're welcome. Thank you.
Thank you, Jared. Thank you also, Anne. It's always a pleasure to be at the Sydney Institute. We always have a good time here. And thank you, Aaron Patrick, as well. So great to see you again. We haven't seen each other since we both lived in New York City, I think 15 years ago.
That's right.
It's great to see you. Let me begin by saying Malcolm Turnbull is a man whose achievements are quite frankly extraordinary. He has a very successful 36-year marriage, happy, healthy children, to whom he is apparently very close. And he has built several businesses which have created wealth and employment opportunities for many thousands of Australians. He is a millionaire many times over. And he has fought the good fight on issues such as freedom of expression. His background is not perhaps as impoverished as he would occasionally suggest. In a televised debate on Sunday night, perhaps you saw Mr. Turnbull seemed hell-bent on making the case that he was the poorest boy in all of Vaucluse. And when talking about the value of education, he said something about owing everything to Sydney Grammar. Malcolm went from Grammar to Sydney University, as we know, and from there to a Rhodes Scholarship. That is not, in my view, an ordinary background. It is not poverty and disadvantage as most people understand it. Turnbull is today married to a former Lord Mayor of this city, who is a successful businesswoman in her own right. And as a couple, they are unquestionably a wonderful demonstration of what can happen when you're lucky enough to be born with no obvious disadvantage. Turnbull has turned his good luck, born with intelligence and ability, into an extraordinary life. And it's a very inspiring story. We should be very proud of him, at least as proud as he is of himself. And now he is the Prime Minister. And that too is a significant achievement. It is a goal that he has held since he was in his mid-30s, and it must have felt absolutely magnificent when he managed to pull it off. But now Malcolm is on track for a new title, a new achievement, and one he probably never figured on. If the news poll is correct, and the projected swings translate to votes against the coalition in the marginal seats, Malcolm Turnbull will be the worst-performed Prime Minister of the past 10 years. Worse than Julia Gillard, worse than Kevin Rudd, and worse than Tony Abbott, who he displaced. And if you think that's a big call, then I'll define it this way. Kevin Rudd was able to get himself elected in 2007, and Tony Abbott managed to get himself elected in 2013. Julia Gillard didn't quite get there, but she was at least able to cobble together a coalition with herself at the helm. Now Turnbull has never won an election in his own right. And if he can't, he will be the only one of that group that didn't. His prime ministership, as we know, has never been confirmed by the electorate. He came to power by gathering the votes of 53 members of his own party, by convincing them to knife Tony Abbott and install Turnbull instead. And so here we are now, halfway to his day of reckoning. What does the public think? In the immediate aftermath, there was considerable joy. Malcolm Turnbull enjoyed stratospheric popularity when he first took over. And advisers, including many friendly media commentators, urged Malcolm to go to the polls. More than one person said, "Go early if you want to win. Go on Valentine's Day and you will walk a path of rose petals back to the lodge." But Turnbull didn't go early. And why he didn't is anyone's guess. My guess is that he thought his approval rating was so spectacularly high that it could never fall far enough to put his prime ministership at risk. The idea that he might lose doesn't seem to have occurred to him. His self-belief is something marvellous to behold. He believes he is the best choice for the nation. And therein lies the problem. An election campaign is not like running a company. Turnbull has succeeded in life and in business because he knows how to wait, and he knows how to plot, and he knows when to strike. This is a different kind of race. For the first time in his life, he can't just tell people what to do. He has to convince them. So how's he doing? Better this week than last is about the best I'm prepared to say. According to this week's polls, the Coalition is facing the prospect of losing 10 seats in New South Wales, 6 in Queensland, 3 in WA, which is enough to lose the election. Satisfaction with Turnbull himself has fallen by 18 points since Christmas and is now lower than the 37% that Tony Abbott enjoyed when he was knifed. So what has gone wrong? I'm going to say three things. Some of the slump in Malcolm's popularity can be traced straight back to the progressives, who are disappointed that he hasn't done more. These are the people who keep going on about the real Malcolm. Where is the Malcolm who supports same-sex marriage? Where is the Malcolm who is concerned about climate change? Where is Malcolm the acceptable conservative? Did any of these people ever vote for Malcolm Turnbull? Maybe in the seat of Wentworth, I think yes, where the Labor candidate Evan Hughes is running a fun campaign based on the slogan, "I miss Malcolm." Also, Evan's other slogan is, "Make Point Piper great again." In real life, it's not clear how many of these people ever would have voted Conservative, but their disappointment explains a little of why Malcolm is slipping in the polls. Perhaps you've seen the Fizzer posters, that's what they're about. Which brings me to the second point, the Delcons, the delusional Conservatives, people who are upset because they don't like what Turnbull did to Tony Abbott. That's fine, what he did was snaky, but this is not the time for a protest vote, and I don't think that any of those people will actually vote Green. Turnbull's bigger problem, it is losing the people known as Tony's tradies. They're not necessarily the middle class, because everyone in Australia thinks of themselves as middle class, but they are the middle ground, the centre, the bulk of voters. People who are earning an okay income, they've got a couple of kids, but they feel like they're losing ground. People who aren't necessarily worried about going broke or being able to feed the family, but don't want to slip from the middle. In the words of John Howard, they don't feel relaxed and comfortable. And the news poll result reflects that. You cannot afford to lose your base. Why do they feel nervous? One argument I think has to be the own goal that the Coalition kicked on superannuation. If you listen to talkback radio, superannuation is the sleeper issue of this campaign. It is a much bigger issue than negative gearing. Much bigger. When you make changes to super that could even be retrospective, you rock your base. When Julia Bishop was talking on radio today, she could not even explain those changes. This is a devastating result for the Coalition. Nervousness there on super caps will cost him votes. The other thing that Malcolm Turnbull has had to put up with, and who predicted this, is that Shorten has gotten better. He's sharpened his answers, he's lost weight, he looks enthusiastic. He's talking about growth, he's talking about fairness, He's talking about Medicare. He's talking about schools. People understand this stuff. They may not believe that Labor can pay for it, but at least they understand it. The Coalition's message is not clear. It needs to become clear before somebody will vote for it. To my mind, the Coalition's best strategy from here on is to do what they are not doing, which is to concentrate on the instability that the country experienced under the Gillard government, to remind people about the excruciating 17-minute speech by Rob Oakeshott. There has been so much turmoil in Canberra this past decade. Turnbull is the fifth Prime Minister in 6 years. To suggest to them that they are perhaps looking at the sixth Prime Minister in 7 years. Now, it's getting very close to bell time, but I think that there is one more question that is perhaps worth asking. Would the Coalition be doing better under Tony Abbott? Would they currently be tracking better? And when I was thinking about that today, I couldn't help also thinking about Donald Rumsfeld. The things that we know, the things that we don't know, but also the things that we will now never know. This is something the Coalition will never know. But for sure, if Turnbull loses this election, it will be his crown that slips. And that will be a personal tragedy for a man who wanted this crown all his life. Thank you.
Aaron Patrick, thanks.
Thanks, Jared. Well, Laura, let me speak to you about company tax and speak to you as someone who has been in business most of their life and understands how business operates, understands how companies make investment decisions. If you want to have something, you want to have more of something, then you lower the tax on it. If you want to have more investment, then you lower the tax on the investment. If you want to have less of something, then you increase the tax. Labor is proposing to increase the tax on investment. That will result in less investment. And if you have less investment, you get less jobs. Now, this is very straightforward. Now, as far as company tax is concerned, over the next 3 years, if we return to government, company tax will come down from 30% to 27.5%. Have I made the point? I can keep going. So that's an excerpt from Malcolm Turnbull's answer on Sunday night, the leaders' debate with Bill Shorten. Now, I don't know how many of you are following that. I could barely follow it, and I was reading it in front of me. That, for me, is an, it shows why Malcolm Turnbull is failing in this campaign. Because, as Carolyn said, very smart guy, but unable to cut through. And I think what we're seeing here in this election campaign is Malcolm Turnbull at his weakest. We are seeing his over-articulateness is undermining his ability to communicate with the population. Essentially, he doesn't know how to deliver a message. And it was hilarious a couple of months ago when Tony Abbott was doing his polypedal through southern New South Wales, and there was a camera there, and they'd set it all up like he was still a Prime Minister. And he rattled off. He said, you know, Labor Party wants to introduce 5 new taxes. And he just reeled them off. And essentially what he was doing was saying to the Liberal Party room who'd opposed him is that I've still got it. I know how to communicate. Malcolm Turnbull gets up there and he tries to explain macroeconomics, the Australian population. That's not what politics is. This is how you do it. So I'm the deputy editor of the Fin Review, and my job is mainly sitting there and editing the front page. And every night we have a news conference, 5 o'clock, and we work out what we're going to put on the front, and we have the screen, and we see all the images coming through from the day. And at the moment, most of them are from the campaign. And day after day, I see high-quality, interesting images coming through of Bill Shorten. Bill Shorten running along the Bondi to Bronte track. Bill Shorten buying his wife flowers today. Bill Shorten having a cup of coffee. And then you see Malcolm Turnbull, Malcolm Turnbull in his suit and tie. Malcolm Turnbull behind this horrible blue screen with a picture of Australia on it and writing that you can't read. And we had to ask them, what is it? And they said, well, that's the new coalition symbol. Okay, instead of just simple... That, for me, symbolises the inability of this coalition campaign to communicate. So I was talking to a liberal, I said, well, what's going on? You know, why are things going so badly? And he said, look, Malcolm Turnbull only listens to two people. One of them's Lucy, and one of them's Sally Cray. Sally Cray, his principal private secretary, and he's surrounded by sycophants, and he won't take advice from anyone. So you're seeing this remarkable event in this campaign where the absence of Peter Credlin is being felt. This campaign shows what Peter Credlin's great strength was. You know, possibly the most maligned woman in Australian politics on the right in modern history. But Credlin had a great strength, which was organisational capability. Okay, and she knew how to stand up to the Prime Minister, and she wasn't awed by the Prime Minister, and she wasn't a sycophant. And she was attacked for that. She was attacked as she. We called her. People called her the most powerful person in the government, but not in a positive sense. Okay, but what Credlin could do was she knew how to set up an advance team. And when Turnbull was leader of the opposition, he didn't have a strong advance team. When her and Abbott came in, they set up a very strong advance team. That's just one of the things that she did. Okay, so the sound grabs, the images are all going in favour of Shorten. Now, one of the most remarkable things Carolyn touched upon is Bill Shorten. Bill Shorten, in the space of, 3 months, has completely transformed his image. A couple of years ago, he was this PM-killing faction numbers man who came out of a possibly corrupt union. You know, he was investigated by the police for serious sexual assault. He dumped his wife. He has some serious baggage. And he's come out here and he's turned into Mr. Nice Guy. And it's working. And it's working because he understands the power of television. And he's comfortable. He's comfortable campaigning. He always has been. And he enjoys it. And he has that great ability to just get on the stump and talk to people in a natural way, in the way that Turnbull can't. So, Bill Shorten also isn't bound by the consistency of his position. So all his life he's worked to build up close relationships with business people, benefited from them. Richard Pat was a great mentor to him. There's other people he loves seeing. When he's a trade unionist, he tried very hard to build up his relationship with business. At the moment, he's running a very anti-business line. So you see today he's talking about placing the 49% top tax rate permanently on the books. You know, that's a pretty big step back in terms of modern Labor ideology. Okay, you go back to Hawke and Keating and Blairism and Bill Clinton. You have these centrist capitalists on the left. Okay, and what is widely regarded as, say, one of Labor's biggest problems in the UK was when Tony Blair stepped down, Gordon Brown stepped up to be Prime Minister, and he raised the top marginal tax rate. I think it was to 49. It may not have been exactly 49, but it was definitely in that area. So what we've got here, so they're the players, okay? Let's talk about the stumbles. The great stumble of this campaign was David Feeney. David Feeney, not so well known here, but he always wanted to be the Graham Richardson to Bill Shorten's Bob Hawke. I went to university with David, and I remember one day he was running a candidate to try and take over the science club. I was in my first year, and his candidate was so unpopular that even though they stuffed about 80 false votes in the ballot box, they still lost. David had this love-hate relationship with Bill. Bill was part of this group called Network, which essentially was his first political organisation that he ran. And some of the people on Network, including the current Victorian Attorney General, became major figures in the party. Anyway, there was a massive falling out, partly because of Bill's ego, and Bill went and joined what was perceived then as the dark side, which was David Feeney. You know, David Feeney, just the guy who carried on, you know, stacking branches. So turns out, though, David isn't the greatest poster child for the Labor Party current policy on negative gearing, because he negative gears his house. But David, in a way, symbolised how the Labor Party, at least in Victoria, where it's probably a bit less corrupt than here in New South Wales, operated. Because essentially it was this elite social group. And you had this interesting dynamic where you had David's wife, who's a partner at Maurice Blackburn, Libby Sanger. We had Bill Shorten's first wife, Deborah Beale, who was the daughter of one of the richest men in Parliament at the time and very close to the Pratts. And you had Kathy Jackson. And these three women were all drinking buddies and they'd all go out, but they were also politically entwined too, because David wanted to have a union backing him just like Bill did and Stephen Conroy. And Bill had the AWU, Stephen had the TWU, and so David latched onto Kathy so he would have the HSU. Okay. Now, it all fell apart pretty spectacularly because it turns out Kathy was corrupt. And the marriage ended between Bill and Deborah. And now David has sort of destroyed, at least in the short term, this atmosphere he had of being this great political player. Yeah. Turns out he couldn't really cut it on the national stage in the middle of an election campaign. So I think David Feeney wins the award for the biggest stumble of the campaign so far. Now, the third point I want to talk about, which is the issues. What's the issues in this campaign? And this, I think, is actually where a profound change has taken place in Australian politics. And I would argue this is the first time since 2007 that the election and politics predominantly hasn't been about personalities. It's not about... there are some personalities involved, so it's not about personalities, but it's not predominantly about personalities. Ever since Kevin 07 came in and he'd saved the country from boring old John Howard, and we went through the great trauma of replacing him with Gillard, then going back, and then Tony Abbott, Peter Credlin, politics in Australia has been a soap opera. And I would argue that under Turnbull and Shorten, two relatively conventional politicians, it's become an issue of substance. And the issue of substance is pretty profound, which is the size of the state, the size of the taxation system. And Labor Party is unashamedly arguing for a bigger state and a bigger tax system. School spending, education spending, health spending. And Malcolm Turnbull is arguing for lower taxes. Now, I think Malcolm Turnbull's got the hardest sell because he's been told by Treasury and he's been told by the experts that company tax cut is going to be good for the economy. And I don't think there's anything harder to sell to Australians than a company tax cut. They just don't believe it. They just don't believe it. I've had arguments with people. Very intelligent people on the left just refuse to believe the academic view that a company tax cut is going to be good for the economy. So Turnbull's trying to sell something pretty hard to sell. On the other hand, you've got Shorten there out selling 49% top marginal tax rate. And that's a pretty big deal too for people... People who earn over 180,000. That goes to what kind of society we are. How do we tax wealthy? How do we tax the successful? How do we tax the people who work hard? What I think is driving this on the left is that I think Shorten knows it's going to be very hard for him to win. He's doing well in the polls, but there just doesn't seem... There's no sense of crisis in Australian society. There's no sense of massive failure. There's a sense of disappointment, sure, in the government, and that Turnbull wasn't as amazing a leader as we'd all hoped he'd be. But I'm not convinced that there is the sense of such a great sense of disappointment that it would lead to a first term government being thrown out, which is a pretty rare thing to happen. And I suspect the Labor Party's realised that too. So they're doing a traditional left wing high taxing policy to shore up the base, to get them within striking distance of winning power next time. I think that's their strategy, and I think Turnbull's strategy is he's prepared to lose some votes, lose some seats, lose 10, maybe 15 seats, like Hawke did in 84, and then lock in what he thinks will be lower taxes, a stronger economy, and bed down for a stronger economy which could drive a victory in the following election. Anyway... That's my speech. Thank you.
So many thanks to both our speakers, who were briefer than we even asked for. So we've got plenty of time until the top of the hour for questions and discussion. So first of all, I just want to say thanks to King and Wood Mellisons for making this great facility available to the Sydney Institute this evening. So we come to questions and discussion. So I'll just lead off briefly. I think if you both come up here, and I'll go over here, and you stay on either side of the microphone. We speak into the microphone.
I just want to bring my little notes, because I have here the seats that I think are most at risk. So if
that's
we want to go there,
we will
we can
a
go there.
But before we do go there, just following up on Aaron's final point, which you think that the Turnbull government will be re-elected and then we'll have an agenda. But the way those polls are looking, it doesn't look great for the Senate, does it? So how are you both seeing the Senate outcome? Let's start with Aaron and then go to...
I think the Senate's going to be an entirely, entirely different beast, and one of Turnbull's achievements, which won't become apparent till after the election, is that the Senate will be cleaned out. So he's changed the optional preferential voting will kill all the micro parties. Now, Nick Xenophon may well have the balance of power or the Greens, but there'll be people that the government will be able to negotiate with legislation by legislation. And so you'll stop essentially what is the circus going on there, and it'll provide just an opportunity for horse trading. So I think it'll be completely played to the side of whichever party wins power.
Carolyn?
Yeah, I'm not so optimistic. I don't think that's necessarily right. Isn't it interesting? Has anyone heard anything about the ABCC? Do you remember that's why we went to the polls, right? That's why we had to have the double solution. I haven't heard it mentioned once in the whole campaign. And it was such a critical issue, right? So that seems to me a bit strange. I was also amazed that the independent senators did what they did and voted against this and essentially put themselves into extinction. Extraordinary, I thought. It's just an extraordinary idea. Because not all of them will get back, but I think some might. I think Jackie Lambie might. You don't need that many votes in Tasmania. I think it's around 40,000. And she's pretty popular, if you saw her on Q&A. I mean, that's a real wild card. The Greens will certainly get a couple, so there could still be an interesting balance of power.
Right, so... Yes.
Thank you. To what extent do you believe that the more right-wing radio commentators, the shock jocks, if you want to call it that, have been bagging Turnbull for about the last 6 to 8 months? To what extent do you think that's had an effect on his popularity and possibly the bringing together the margins between the Liberal and the Labour Party?
There's really a question about Ray Hadley and Alan Jones in Sydney, I think. Yeah.
I would say this. I would say that Malcolm Turnbull clearly thinks it's a problem because otherwise he wouldn't have gone on the Alan Jones program. They had been at war for 2 years and Malcolm Turnbull had refused to go on the Alan Jones program for a long time, which is always a terrific mistake. I mean, this is a contest of ideas, and Malcolm Turnbull is an incredibly smart man, often the smartest person in the room, and boy, do you know it when he's there. So the idea that you would not go on somebody's radio station and have the confidence in your own ideas and the confidence in your ability to sell them is to me a strategic error. But the fact that he's gone back on the show suggests to me that he thinks it's a problem, even if other people don't.
Right. Do you want to make a comment on that? There's a question down the back. Don't stand in front of the camera. Yeah. Okay, start. Yeah.
I'm not sure which of the three constituents I fall into, Carolyn, but I do like the way you framed the electorate.
You can be all three.
Aaron's point, from my perspective, one great disappointment and the promise that Malcolm had of treating people with intelligence and taking bold policy positions out there. Do you think that beyond this election we'll actually see any boldness, or are we going to just go back to the three-letter or three-word slogans and populist positions? Seems like he fell off that high promise pretty quickly.
Well, look, I would say this. I think that a lot of the disappointment comes from people who are fundamentally naive in their political beliefs, because Malcolm Turnbull leads a centre-right party. So there was just no way he was going to do the things that they want him to do. I mean, as he said the other day, he paid a very high price for his support for change on climate change. And when you take over the leadership of a party, you make all kinds of compromises to get there. And I feel that people are terribly disillusioned, for example, that he didn't do what is absolutely the right thing and recognise same-sex marriage. I mean, that is the civil rights argument of our time. The fact that our brothers, sisters, aunts, uncles, grandparents are kept out of an institution like marriage is a civil rights issue. And the fact that he didn't move on it should not have surprised them. I personally think it's a tragedy, but I think people who are disillusioned by that are being a little naive.
I think we will see some major changes after the election if Turnbull wins. I think we'll have an ETS by stealth. I think Greg Hunt has introduced a system which can easily be converted into an ETS, and he's done it very quietly and very cleverly. I think Turnbull will feel free, if he gets a mandate, to show his more liberal side, perhaps on issues like same-sex marriage, recognition of Indigenous people into the Constitution, and changes to taxation mix. And so I think Turnbull's a man who's going to use his power. He's just waiting for the right moment. He's waiting till he's got his mandate.
Question here.
Just wanted to know what your thoughts were on the council amalgamations and their impact on New South Wales seats.
You may need to background. It relates to the New South Wales. And
it's actually the New South Wales Parliament, the state parliament, is seeking an amalgamation of councils, as happened in Victoria, I think, about 10 years ago under Geoff Kennett. So this is very similar action being taken by Mike Baird. I live in one of the councils that isn't being amalgamated, in the seat of Waverley, but that it has its own problems with the redevelopment of the pavilion that's creating a lot of angst. And we've had council meetings where people have been spat at, and we've had actors and union organisers turning up for public protests. I'm pretty sure that the public differentiates between what are essentially local issues and federal issues. I think Aaron was absolutely on the money when he said that this election is being fought on the big issue of how big is the state, not how big is our local council.
Do you want to add to that?
No.
Right.
I'm a bit in a quandary about whether polls tell us anything anymore, particularly after some of the things that have happened over the last few years with polls. And today the Essential poll had the Liberals back in front, 51-49, and Essentials not known to favour the Liberals. All these polls have got their own positions. And Morgan has come back to a very narrow margin. And I just wonder if in all of this we're confused between whether it's a presidential election or a party election. And my own gut feeling is that why most people, the betting people will tell you this, think that Malcolm Turnbull or the Liberals will win is that we're not ready for Labor again, which is goes back to this taxation problem, goes back to this boat people problem, goes back to the idea that under Labor we went backwards. It may not have been Labor's problem, but we don't want to go back to that again.
Wow, well, that's a pretty that's a pretty interesting argument. We're not, is Australia ready for Labor again? It feels like, though, that isn't discussed very often. It feels like, what was a farce? How do you remove a first-term prime minister, one of the most popular in history, replace him with Australia's first female prime minister, and then have that ex-prime minister ruthlessly undermine her for 3 years, and then 3 months before an election sack her and put him back in? Like, how do you do that? And I always think, I think those members of Labor caucus who voted for Rudd the second time made a huge mistake. They should have just stuck with Gillard, even if they were going to lose 10 more seats, just so they could look at themselves in the mirror. And but we're not discussing that, you know. And Shorten has published this book. What's it, For the Common Sense or For the Common Good?
For the Common Good.
Yes, and he completely glosses over, and it's so misleading about his role in those two leadership changes. It's ridiculous. So it sort of bemuses me having written a book about what happened then, and we're going to that in great detail, that no one talks about.
Yeah, I think you're on the money, and I think, as I said in my little address, the Coalition's best bet is to continue to remind Australians what that was like. because that really was a circus. It was like living in Italy. It was like, you know, a Cicciolina kind of situation. And it was really uncomfortable for a lot of people, in addition to which there were real structural problems that Australia had to deal with that we're still dealing with. The 50,000 people who arrived by boats has become just a slogan, but they were real people. And really, 1,200 people really did drown. You know, it's not just an election slogan. It was real, and they were real. And so I think you're dead, absolutely dead right. If the coalition is able to concentrate its campaigning on the previous Labor government, people won't go back there.
Question up the front.
There's an old saying that all warfare is based on deception. And this is a very long campaign, and there hasn't been one negative ad from the, or much negative posturing from the Liberal Party. Perhaps this is wishful thinking in some respects, but do you believe that they're playing dumb for a while before they run hard the next couple of weeks?
Yeah, I think that... Sorry? No, I'm making a point. I think that both sides have got some really fantastic negative ads ready to roll out. Can't wait to see them, because I think it should be hugely entertaining. Although, I think there's a few anti-terminal runs, a few anti-terminal ones running on Sky at the moment. So, but look, I think in terms of tactics, isn't the... Someone's going to stuff up. One of the leaders is going to stuff up really badly at some point. They always do. And so the question is...
The glee in his eyes.
It's going to happen. It's going to happen, you know. So, you know, the question is, can the other side exploit that?
You know, part of the problem is that some of the greatest minds in advertising have moved on. People like Ted Horton made extraordinary ads. And even to some extent John Singleton, who made amazing ads. A lot of those people aren't in the game anymore. And I don't know whether the calibre of the current group are up to it. I'd like to think so. I like a good ad campaign as much as anyone.
There's a question there.
Hi, my name's Elizabeth. I was just going to go on from that point, particularly with regard to the particularly talking about their media skills. And it's not that hard, as you would appreciate where you're sitting, for executives who are trained to have excellent media skills. So why is it that particularly Malcolm is missing all those great opportunities to convey a message? You can be trained to convey a very complex message very simply, and he keeps using things like, it's just common sense, which is one of the most patronising phrases you can say, which to my mind is a tell, you know, that stupid way to answer a question, but why do you think they're answering the question so stupidly? Oh. Why is anyone coaching them on this? To me, it's just 101.
Well, I mean, again, Aaron hit on it absolutely in his presentation where he said Malcolm will not listen. He will not take advice. And I have been amazed, Elizabeth, amazed by his missteps in communication. So, for example, when he went out west and did that bizarre stunt with the parents who bought their baby a house so that they could, like, no child will grow up without a property that hasn't been negatively geared. I mean, that is like a bizarre thing for anyone to do. But I think Aaron got it right. He does not listen.
And what is Malcolm Turnbull doing telling John Fang that his kid should buy a house?
Yes.
You know? Now, of course he should. You know, John Fang's pretty well paid. But you just don't say it, you know.
And on Alan the other morning, he said, Alan, well, you and I don't have this sort of a problem.
It was so aloof, okay. Wasn't it? It was lofty, very lofty.
Now we've got to move on. Over there, yep.
Carol, like you mentioned that superannuation will be one of the big issues of this election. You said that the changes that the Liberal Party made would be a threat to Tony's treaties. I was just wondering, why would they possibly vote for Labor when the Liberal Party would still be perceived as the greatest generator of wealth for those people with comfortable incomes?
You know, for a lot of people, I know it's hard sometimes for this message doesn't often get across, but for a lot of people, the difference between living on the pension and living on superannuation is not that great. They just don't have that much super. We like to think, and sometimes Malcolm Turnbull talks as if everyone's got 1.6 million, but that's not the reality for most people. I would be surprised if Malcolm knows many people who are going to depend on superannuation to retire. I believe, I would be surprised. And for a lot of people, it's going to have to be a mix of both. They might be able to rely on their super for a while, but then they're going to have to go on a pension. And so I think when you mess around with super, it really frightens people because that's their money and they've been putting it away, diligently saving, hoping that they'll be able to have a nice retirement, we can have a nice dinner with your wife and take a trip every now and then. And suddenly when that's a threat, I think that you are more likely to go with the party that promises you more security in your pension.
Stuart.
Oh. Aaron, you said that Tony Abbott's political skills seem to be missing in the election for the Liberals. Do you think that after the election, if the government's returned, he could come back in cabinet, do you think, or in opposition? Could you see him coming back into a leader in the opposition situation?
That's a tough question. One of my favourite stories about Tony Abbott and Peter Credlin was that one day Peter Credlin, really upset. Sorry, one of the advisors in the office had really upset Peter Credlin, and this was causing Abbott, conniptions. So he takes the guy aside and says, "Listen, can you smooth it over with her?" So he goes and buys her an expensive bunch of flowers. And she says, "Thank you." That afternoon, Margie Abbott comes into the office. Credlin couldn't be more pleased to see her. Gives her the flowers. So the problem is that Tony Abbott's relationship with Credlin became such a sore point across the whole government. And he allowed it to become such a distraction to the point where everyone in the country was talking about it. And the fact that he allowed it to get to that point essentially destroyed the Liberal Party room's faith in his judgment. And so while they recognise he knows how to deliver a line and he's probably got, he has got a good sense of what the community thinks and how to win votes. But they just don't trust him. I don't think they don't trust him.
Not even the cabinet?
Well, they want him to go. They just want him to go. I speak to Liberals and they're just saying, "Would you please just piss off?" Okay, and he won't do it because he wants to get back to cabinet. So, I don't know.
Karen, do you want to mention that?
Yeah, no, I don't agree with you. And the reason I don't agree with you is because I think that Malcolm Turnbull undermined Tony Abbott from day one. I think that Turnbull had already been leader of the opposition once before, then lost it, then he'd come in and out of government and all that jazz. And he didn't want to hang around for another 15 years for Tony to run his time, or even another 8 for Tony to have his time. He wanted it now, and he waited like a snake. He waited, and he worked on the weak points, and Peter Credlin was absolutely one of them. But he wanted to be Prime Minister, and he wanted it in this term. And I think that there are people in the party and in the wider community who are concerned about that.
OK, there's a question there. Yeah, Robert.
If the Malcolm we've got is different to the Malcolm we were expecting, and if, as Aaron suggests, the Malcolm we might get is different to what we've currently got, how do we get the Malcolm we want?
Well, which one is it? Look, one of Malcolm Turnbull's family friends said to me, the thing is about Turnbull is that he's a vessel upon which we project our impressions of what a good politician is. Mm. He said, "Listen, Turnbull is just out there. When you meet him, he's out there to see what he can get from you, not what he can do for you." Mm. So, now I say that in a morally neutral sense, in that I don't necessarily think that politicians or political leaders have to be pure people. I think there's a legitimate argument to make they don't even have to be ethical. But if they follow, as long as they follow the law and they provide good leadership and they enact positive policies, they're doing what the democratic system has been designed to do. So I think we were always going to be disappointed by Malcolm because we didn't really understand who he was.
Do you want to add to that? No. Okay, there's a question here.
Could there be a parallel between the British election, the polls between them before the British election, and the polls now? Remember the shy talk? It was all going to be so very close, and then the shy Tories came out and voted.
The shy Tories. They're very shy, the Tories.
Probably. Maybe. But who knows? Like, who knows? But maybe, yeah, of course. Polls have been notoriously wrong.
Not ours. It seems to me that they are caught in a bit of a death grip with each other at the moment. And as far as I can tell, Shorten hasn't been able to reach out and get any of the coalition's voters, and Malcolm hasn't been able to reach out and get any from the other side. And you have to do that. If you're going to change the government, you have to do that. And so if that doesn't happen, Turnbull will win.
Question next.
Yes, thanks for the invitation. Jane Stiles from the National Rail, Tram and Bus Union. I was interested in what both speakers said. I know a lot of the players in the Labor Party. I was thinking that I've got this feeling that this election will determine where Australia is heading for the next 10 years, so it's very important which way the country votes. What if it's a close result? Where will that leave us? I'm just interested in the speaker's views on how these two players will happen in the future with a close election result.
Do you mean a hung parliament?
Not necessarily, but even that would be interesting. What's your view on that?
I'm not quite sure what scenario you're painting there, James.
Don't ask the audience because they'll answer.
I'm talking about a close election where there's not a clear result for either side.
Well, let's say there's a hung parliament. What would the outcome be there?
Well, then you'll have this amazing competition between two men who think they're the best deal doers there ever were. And Bill's been doing deals since he was 18 and cutting faction numbers at Young Labor. You know, I was with him there and he loved it. And and all throughout his trade union days, he was a guy who loved to do a deal. And he was National Secretary. And are you the State Secretary of the union?
No, I'm only a National Vice President.
Okay. Well, he was the National Secretary, and so his job was primarily administrative. And generally, a National Secretary, and any AWU is a big union, 100,000 members. And so normally you'd expect him to get directly involved in, I reckon, three negotiations a year, high-profile national ones, because you had a hierarchy to deal with it. He was out doing them every week. He loved travelling around the country, going there, getting there, cutting the deal, because it reinforced his sense of a man who could achieve things for his workers, a man at the front line, a man who could bring people together, of a Bob Hawke-like charismatic political figure. Then you had Malcolm Turnbull, who's been doing deals, you know, since he walked into Kerry Packer's office in Park Street and said, you know, I'm the man who can help you make even more money. So I think it'd be one hell of a show.
I don't think it'll happen. Firstly, I don't think it happened. But I did want to say that I really agree very strongly with your premise that this election is incredibly important because we have had so much turmoil over the past 7 years since Kevin Rudd was first elected in 2007. And it is time. It is time for us to settle down. The next 10 years are very, very important. There's an argument that we wasted the most extraordinary economic boom that this country has ever seen. And we really have to get back on track. And I just wanted to say I accept your premise.
Norton Osman.
I had the good luck to be away from Australia until quite recently, so I missed the early part of the campaigning. But to pick up on a point that Carolyn mentioned briefly, I haven't seen, and perhaps there has been, any real battling of the unions. Wouldn't this be something that is in the coalition's interest?
Any real bashing of the unions, would it be in the coalition's interest? Well, there's been a bit of CFMEU bashing going on. I think, in terms of the union movement is so weakened by structural changes in the economy. Also, I think by tacking the union movement more broadly, as opposed to what he sees as the illegal actions of the CFMEU, will draw attention to the one thing that coalition supporters, business supporters are desperate for him to do, and which he knows is politically toxic, which is industrial relations changes. And so the coalition, and particularly the Liberal Party, has been so scarred by what happened in 07 that they just will not touch work choices or touch any kind of liberalisation of the IR system. Even though the senior bureaucrats tell them they should, and that's the way to drive down unemployment, because they're so terrified of it, and that's why.
There is a question. Just, okay.
Well, this is an invitation for Carolyn to go through your list of electorates you think have got to go.
I have a
but
list.
I'm just to see whether or not there are any knife-edge ones there. I've got a sense that there won't be many big changes, that those seats, like the sort of Chris Bowen seats that became slightly marginal out the west, will then move back to their traditional owners, for want of a better term, and that we won't actually have much of a swing. But I'm interested in your point.
So this is the suggestion that the government's doing okay in the marginal seats.
So I don't necessarily have the list of the ones that I think would fall, but I think that the seats that I think are probably most important, Lindsay. Lindsay is absolutely critical for the Liberal Party.
Lindsay is
New South Wales.
Right. Yep.
The incumbent, Fiona Scott, is a Liberal, but that seat has previously been held by the Labor Party. It was won by Jackie Kelly in the room in the Great Howard sweep back to power. That one is critical. Burt in WA has no incumbent. Now, because of the redistribution up there, the Liberal Party has to win it. But there is a swing against the Liberal Party in WA, and I'm just not sure that they can do it. Paterson, notionally Labor.
It's Northern New South Wales.
Northern New South Wales. Could be. But the candidate there, Baldwin, is retiring, and he has done a lot of work on the ground. So I'm thinking that that's in trouble. Dobell. Now, Dobell, the Liberal Party won because that was Craig Thompson's seat. But are they going to be able to hold it? Because it's traditionally a Labor seat, and it only went because of Craig Thompson. And then McEwen in Melbourne is the other one I think that is problematic. Those are the ones that I will be watching on election night, because I think that's going to give you... I mean, of course you can watch Eden Monaro and all the traditional bellwether seats, but those ones are the ones, and I looked out at some of the graphs that were done today that I thought, that's where we're going to see. Do you have any that you...
Now, look, I love seeing the Labor-Greens contests. Don't you see them eating each other apart? I mean, that's some of the most fantastic ones. Melbourne's pretty good. Because it's one of the great ironies of politics. As these inner city seats become more affluent, they become more left-wing. And the Liberal base hates the Greens, and they do not want to preference them. But the Liberal leadership knows it's just a fantastic way to destabilise them.
Can I just say the one exception to the inner city affluent rule is the seat of Wentworth, which is my seat, and it votes 66% of people vote for Malcolm Turnbull, and that was before he was the Prime Minister. It's extraordinarily affluent, and it votes coalition.
So it's Sydney affluent.
Which makes it the most affluent.
It's a bit different from Brunswick or Fitzroy North.
The people who live in those inner west...
Hang on, this is the final...
The people who live in Wentworth.
They are.
They're different kinds. They have gardens, they have terraces, and they have grubby little two-bedders and things that have got wonderful backyards. And they're mostly going to have a pension from the state.
And they wear sandals.
There's one party which is crucial to the election, and no one's watching... What's going to happen to the National Party? It's quite possible they'll pick up two seats in country Victoria.
I thought you were going to say Xenophon. I mean, Xenophon is a real risk.
Because everyone's talking about it, but I think the National Party is the one to watch.
Hang on, we're just going to make this the final question. So their comments are required on the National Party and on Xenophon in South Australia and perhaps elsewhere.
I'm sorry, National Party. It's the Cowboys.
Well, hang on just a minute. Well, let's talk. In the National Party, there's Barnaby Joyce running in New England.
Indi.
Indi and the one, Murray. Is it Murray?
Murray Goulburn.
We've got an independent one and a retiring Liberal in the other. And they were both National Party seats. Not too far.
Okay, so the challenge, the evolution for the National Party is that with an orthodox Liberal Party philosophy of free trade and less government intervention in the state, how does a National Party in coalition with that satisfy an electorate which regards those policies as an anathema for how it survives? You know, Australian farming communities, dairy farmers, you know, they want state subsidies.
Okay.
Well, dairy farmers and Indi.
We're going to move on. Carolyn?
I think you said it perfectly.
You were talking about Xenophon.
Xenophon. I mean, obviously Xenophon is critical, but you're right, everybody's talking about it. I mean, what is he going to do? I personally think he's not going to get quite the support we think, because I wonder if in the general voting population people are a little bit concerned about the kind of thing we talked about before, which is putting too many notionally independents, or in this case Xenophon Party players in the parliament.
So look, I think that's a good occasion on which to conclude with a few stabs about what may or may not happen. Look, it's been a great night tonight. We've had two very well-informed speakers, Karen Overington and Aaron Patrick, and both know their politics well, but they also know the players in Australian politics very well through the years of reporting and writing, currently in The Australian on the one hand and The Financial Review on the other. So we're grateful to have both our speakers on tonight, and thanks to everyone here tonight for asking a lot of very stimulating questions or making important points for discussion. So I'd like to thank both of our speakers, and we'll see what happens. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.